You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 6th January, I'm Simon Brown, coming at you loud and recorded from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Professor Adrian Saville, Gordon Institute of Business Science, on the age of fracture, the shift of economic and political power as it continues to shift from the West towards the East. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Professor Adrian Saville, Gordon Institute of Business Science. Adrian, appreciate the time. A presentation you were mentioning to me that you are doing, a new one, The Age of Fracture, Power Politics and the New Global Map. 2025 has been a year in every sense. I suppose my first question is this really all starting and revolving around President Trump in his second term?
Simon, it's great talking with you. You know, 25 has been a big year from a political perspective, and it is built on the back of 24, which was an even bigger year from a political perspective. You know, you volunteer very early in our conversation, Trump. Mm-hmm. Certainly he matters, but, you know, I think he's a piece of evidence rather than the big story, because here, to my mind, is the big story that over the course of 2024, rolling into 2025, more people went to the polls as a percentage of world population than any year in history. So, you know, if we're looking for democratic moments, 2024 rolling into 25, that was it. Now, there's two striking features of this. The first is that overwhelmingly democracy held, that the institution held. There's a big story in that in and of itself, that you've got institutional sort of rigor and grit. The however is that more than two-thirds of those elections, there was a change in political power. And we can go to our neighbor Botswana, 58 years of same party, change of party after 58 years. South Africa, under a national unity government now, after decades of ANC rule. We could go to the UK, we can go to France, we can go to, of course, the United States. And then, you know, for me, the capstone is where Takeuchi Sainai is elected head of state. Although the party stays the same in Japan, the LDP, they have elected a woman as the head of state. So there's this political, the plates have shifted. And why I would venture that this is more than just a moment is, generally speaking, the way we vote tends to be habitual. We vote more or less the same next time the way we voted last time.
Yeah.
And there's a temptation to say, you know, what you're seeing at the polls is a whole bunch of people changing their minds. I don't think that that's what's going on. I think what's happening is different voters are making the choices and they're determining different outcomes. That is fracture number one for the next decade.
I take your point. And, you know, democracy is about change, although, as you rightly point out, in many, many cases, it isn't. I mean, you get sort of incumbents who kind of get there forever and a day and continue. And in one sense, we could say, well, this is actually the cornerstone of it. As you said, democracy in 2024 held up. I mean, it was a poster child for success of the process. And part of that is things change. But I like your idea that it's perhaps different people coming to vote. We saw in New York recently with young people voting for the mayor.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly the point is, you know, first you've got institutions holding. And we know in the work that you and I have spoken about before, the six-factor model that I'm responsible for, one of the factors of sustained, inclusive, prosperous economic performance, social well-being, one of the factors is institutional strength and stability. And here is an important institution that has held.
It absolutely has. The trick then is, and we're seeing the changes, are those changes fracturing because we are so used to perhaps a status quo? Is this what's sort of starting to drive the wedge where, and politicians are patently, they, you know, in 2025, they are looking back at what happened last year and how to position themselves.
You know, so Simon, we've made a whole sort of 3 minutes without saying Trump.
Yeah.
But without question, President Trump was the disruptor of this story. Yes, democracy held. President Trump was elected. He's now in charge of what looks like, you know, something approximating chaos rather than clarity. But the political shift is just one facet. We need to add into this arrangement the economic shift, which is moving much slower, but much more steadily. And what's happening with the world year after year after year is step by step, we're being taken into an economy that is increasingly east and south, as opposed to the dominant north and west, which reigned for the past 100 odd years of industrialization. All of that has happened under a dominant global north or global west. Mm-hmm. And the world is increasingly becoming global south. And we could add to that, you know, similarly, global south and global east. So the center of world economic gravity is steadily shifting southward and eastward. And with these political changes, I think it equips us to think far more carefully about allegiances and alliances with a world where the center of economic gravity isn't sort of hopping around backwards and forwards. It is steadily progressing and faster than glacial pace. It is steadily progressing southward and eastward. Who are you aligned with in this new political arrangement?
Actually, remembering, and it might have been as far back as a decade ago, a presentation you did where you showed that shift. And of course, it's continuing to happen. I imagine the tariffs as one part of the Trump policy is, you know, Xi Jinping must just be sitting there and smiling as Trump tears up, you know, trade deals with, for example, Canada, who must be, you know, Canada, it's a 9,000 kilometer border. It's the largest undefended border in the world. And that gets torn up. And the likes of Xi Jinping, G20, there was a, I didn't even know there's a Brazil, India, South Africa triumphant that meets. I didn't know they existed. But of course, they met on the sidelines of G20.
So these economic shifts that are progressing steadily, I don't want to say it's impossible that they are interrupted. You know, that would be a foolish venture, but it's very difficult to see how this doesn't continue to reshape and redefine the world so that, you know, let's not think about the next year or 5 years. Sure. Let's think about the next 25 years and fast forward to 2050. Maybe the year is 2060, but by 2050, the world's two biggest economies, China and India. And United States will be playing third place with a bronze.
Absolutely. And this is, and I mean, this is to the game, to the point, this is not a new thing that's happening, but it does mean that other markets, and I'm thinking particularly South Africa, and I'm thinking our president taking trips to Asia, we need to both as countries and governments, but perhaps also as economies and companies, start to be prepared for this eventuality.
You know, these are quick growing places with large populations. So you've brought Asia into the conversation. Southeast Asia is an absolutely fascinating region. It is home to approaching a billion people, and the economies that make up Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, Singapore, Philippines, these economies are romping along with 5 and 6% economic growth. Yes, they're coming off low bases, but this growth is increasingly industrializing and globalizing. Peel back the tongue of your footwear, there's a good chance it says made in Indonesia, made in Vietnam. In perhaps the not too distant future, peel back the bonnet of your vehicle and it might say made in Vietnam.
And that's maybe it, because if I think back to the 80s when you and I were both kids, sort of, you know, in our high schools and stuff, it was made in China was the cheap stuff. Now it's the BYD. I mean, it's iPhones are made in China and India. They've shifted from being, you know, cheap labor to actually being high quality labor.
So, you know, let's stay there, you know, with another source of fracture. So, you know, the first fracture is political. The second fracture, you know, perhaps fracture is the wrong term here. It might be sort of dislocation or relocation as economic. The third fracture is the way we talk, behave, believe. And here I'm making reference to culture. I love that you share our common footprint of the 1980s, where absolutely, you know, and the perception was that if you wanted to be a winner it was American. United States was, that was the dream. And the cheap stuff came from other places. If you look at the narrative today, this has shifted. The badges that certainly dominate South African streets mm-hmm. are no longer American cars. It's Indian and Chinese cars mm-hmm. and, you know, a good smattering of South Korean cars. If you listen in on your kids' music channels, mm-hmm. they are listening to K-pop. And these changes in behaviors translate into changes in beliefs or underpinned by changes in belief. And so culture is a third fracture. And the word fracture here shouldn't be taken, you know, in a negative context at all. It says there is a break and new things are underway.
Agreed on that. It is change. And I mean, part of everything that is the world is around change. And this is brought in. It makes me think around AI, because, of course, one of the things we've all forgotten about in many cases was back in January of 25 was DeepSeek came out, rattled yeah. global sort of AI companies, and then kind of moved on. And now we've got Nano Banana and everything's lovely. But I've been doing digging. I mean, DeepSeek is one of many models coming out of China. They are in many cases cheaper to run, if not in many cases open source. And the big restriction on AI in the US is power, and China has power by the heaps and the ability to generate more and build more power hand over fist. The new frontier, which is, let's take it as an assumption that the next frontier is AI. We all think the US is winning, but that's almost maybe a smokescreen.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things here that you prompt. That's an AI joke, right? There's a couple of things here that you prompted me. The first is, so AI is, you know, let's call it open source and let's call it universal.
Sure.
You and I were chatting just before, you know, we've recorded here about you going online, finding a paper, being able to use this paper to build an analytical tool. And you've done it in a fraction of a second and you've replaced what might have been an army of workers historically. Mm-hmm. So broadly speaking, we have access to this. It's universal.
Yeah.
However, here's the next fracture, that in the case of advanced economies, more developed economies, which we can also read as older economies. The population is older. Mm-hmm. AI is replacing workforce. And for every 100 workers displaced by AI, 60 are created by new jobs. In other words, AI is a net dislocator of workforce in the more established economies. In younger economies, let's wheel back to Southeast Asia, the number is the exact opposite way around. For every 100 workers that are displaced by AI, 40 are injected mm-hmm. as new workers. So there's 140 replaces the 100. So AI is a net job creator in these young, fast-growing, dynamic economies. The second prompt that you take me to is, we're only just beginning with AI. We are on the cusp of quantum machines being commercially available, that you can buy a quantum machine off the shelf. When I say we're on the cusp, I'm not entirely sure what I mean by this. The next 5-10 years, we will have quantum machines, and these quantum machines completely redefine everything as we know it.
And it's something which I was pondering earlier in the year, and I was thinking back to the adoption of the internet. I was very early onto the internet, sort of 92, 93. I had CompuServe. It cost an arm and a leg, but nonetheless.
64K copper dial-up.
I don't even think it was. Was it as much as 64? Maybe. but the thing with it was a gradual, you know, now internet's largely ubiquitous, but it took a decade, maybe two, before it got into everybody's hands. With AI, we all woke up 3 years ago with ChatGPT and billion, I mean, maybe half the planet suddenly had access. It was like a switch got flicked rather than that slow, gradual move. And that can't not have, back to again, fracture, not necessarily in a bad sense, but the speed of its arrival.
I recently produced a paper on digital banking, and it speaks to this point. So, you know, rather than going in the abstract, let's, you know, speak in the practical, you know, the pace at which things move. If you go to 100 years back, 1920, 1930, 1940, it took 30 years to get electricity to the home, to make, I'll borrow your word, ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. It took 3 decades to get universal electricity, 3 decades to get universal radio. Now, the most recent, you know, sort of extraordinary boom, here I am out of the box, was Thread, the social platform, which onboarded 100 million in 24 hours. Now, let's go to banking. The oldest established bank in Latin America, has 80 million customers. It's 160 years old. Mm-hmm. And that is the oldest, you know, established network physical branch bank. More recently, Nubank has launched just a little over 10 years ago. And in the space of 10 years, Nubank has onboarded 120 million customers. I mean, just do the math. 12 million customers per year. You're onboarding a million customers. That's the power of the platform business.
Yeah, yeah. And a quick little rabbit hole. Everyone go read Adrian's book on TimeBank. It's absolutely brilliant. A last point there.
Thanks for the plug.
A last point is, I mean, the US, the UK, Europe, they, the leaders there, they see this happening. They're not ignorant to this. I don't think there's much, there are things they could do to maybe slow it down and the like. But I mean, their destiny is almost out of their hands, or am I oversimplifying?
I wouldn't say it's out of their hands. You know, dynamism comes from the most extraordinary places, but recognize that some of the pieces and parts that they have are deeply entrenched and very, very slow moving. And yeah. In particular, my references to demography, that in aging, graying populations that aren't having babies, that is not the place of dynamism. So that would be my first sort of endorsement of your observation. The second is what worries me in their policy response is they have done the two things that are probably the least effective. They have first gone protectionist, looking inward for solutions. And the second is they're trying to spend their way out of trouble with fiscal profligacy.
Yeah, and neither of those are going to solve the problem. They might win you votes, but they are not going to solve the problem. We're going to leave it there. That's that, Professor Adrian Saville-Gordon, Institute of Business Science. Always appreciate the time. Give your money smoother returns with StanLib Asset Management. The StanLib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
That's it for today. This podcast is brought to you by StanLib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We hear every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nabukle, Seren, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Positive sentiment shift in South Africa.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.